Well, friends, I thought I was going to live a very quiet academic life and never, ever, ever thought I'd have anything to do with media. And yet here we are. I've been doing this for almost 6 years now, and it's made me think a lot about media and my history with the use of media over time and how my attitudes have changed. And I'll say this much, media isn't what I was taught it was when I was a young boy in school. And there is a very rich and tangled history behind that statement. My returning guest is a man whose work I admire very, very much. I think he's one of the most honest and careful men on the internet that I found. He's writer, editor, and webmaster of the Corbett Report website. James Corbett, welcome back to the Catholic Current.
Thank you for having me here, and thank you for hosting this discussion in particular. It's one that's very near and dear to my heart.
And mine as well. James, I grew up as a young boy in the United States in the 1960s, and when Walter Cronkite ended his program, and that's the way it is, July 17th, 1968, you knew that's the way it was. And people used to speculate, you know, someday he's going to retire and he'll make commercials and he'll get rich because he'll be the most trusted man in America. And from my father and then from my teachers, I was taught to be a responsible citizen, you have to be informed. And the way you do that is you go to the news. You go to ABC, CBS, or NBC. You take the local newspaper. For serious events, you would get the New York Times. We lived all the way out in New Jersey, so it was a stretch to get the New York Times. We watched 60 Minutes on Sunday. We got subscriptions to Time Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, Newsweek. All of the things I've just described, James, I wouldn't give them the time of day now. Did they change or did I change? What are your thoughts?
Well, it's particularly interesting that you bring up Walter Cronkite, which for people of my generation, perhaps not quite as resonant, but I know that that growing up, I certainly heard about the story of Walter Cronkite and that's the way the world is. And essentially, this was the voice of God or something very closely equivalent to it for people who followed news in that era. Which is very ironic when you find out that, in fact, did you know Walter Cronkite actually recorded the voice for the owl in the Bohemian Grove cremation of care ritual, which I'm sure there are people in the audience who haven't heard of this, but the
my head just
Grove,
exploded.
Yes. The Bohemian Grove, for those who don't know, is an area of the California Redwoods where every year there is a retreat where actors and members of the Bohemian Society, and oh, by the way, former U.S. presidents and political bigwigs, corporate chieftains, etc., gather to participate in 2 weeks of ribaldry and weirdness, including a presentation called the Cremation of Care, where they commit a mock human sacrifice. It has to be seen to be believed, and fortunately, there has been footage that has come out of the ceremony. But the voice of the owl in that ritual, at least for some period of time, was literally voiced by Walter Cronkite. So that should tell you something. But if you want even more on Cronkite, you could go to, in fact, if you went to YouTube right now and typed in ASI Presents Hillary, Walter Cronkite, and World Government, you will see a special presentation in which Walter Cronkite was receiving an award from the World Federalist Association for his work in forwarding global government. And in this acceptance speech, he notes that religious right-wing leader Pat Robertson has written in a book a few years ago that we should have a world government, but only when the Messiah arrives. He wrote, literally, any attempt to achieve world order before that time must be the work of the devil. Well, join me. I'm glad to sit here at the right hand of Satan. Yes, you can hear Walter Cronkite say that exact phrase. And isn't that particularly interesting? Don't you think his viewers might have been interested in knowing that about him back at the time when they were listening to That's the Way the World Is, coming from this person who is literally, admittedly working towards a specific political agenda? And how does that play into this practice of news gathering and news delivering? So, in fact, I would say that the news has always, always been a tool of manipulation and a way of driving the populace into one political avenue or another. But I think your gradual understanding and reflection on, hey, these sources, news sources don't seem to be telling me the news anymore, at least what I consider to be the news, is probably an experience that a lot of people are having, as that disconnect between what the news makers want to tell us the news is and what we are experiencing in the real world. As that disconnect widens, I think more people are falling through the gap.
Friends, we're talking about the news as social construct, as a product. My returning guest is James Corbett, host of The Corbett Report. We're going to link to his site. It is an excellent site. James, as I grew up, I had a sense of, you know, I want to be informed. I went to school in Washington, D.C., which at that time was a paradox. It was about a small town, and it was the center of the universe. So you'd read the New York Times, read the Washington Post. And I had a sense of, I wanted to be informed because I wanted to know who was pulling the strings. And I thought there was actually, it was a relatively small number, and their strings were rather short. I was in my early 20s at the time. But even that view was naive, wasn't it?
Yes, ultimately, I think so. And for people who really want to understand this, in a sense, I find that I, like yourself, I never in a million years imagined I would have anything to do with the media. So I kind mm-hmm. of fell into this profession, I suppose. I am in some sort of media profession, which I would never have expected. And as a result, I find myself sort of as if I'm in the sausage factory, seeing how the sausage is made, and I really want to relate to people. This is how the sausage is made. You don't understand how very vastly different this is than what you might expect. And I certainly understand that most people simply want to be generally informed about what's happening in the world, things that they might need to know, things that are happening that are important globally and locally, etc., so that they can make informed decisions about their life. So they turn on the news and they expect that that's what they're going to receive. But I am here to tell you that there is no such thing as the news that is written in the stars and that is some sort of product that is just there waiting to be talked about. It is something that is manufactured by people, at best an editorial team sitting in a room somewhere in New York or some other broadcast center deciding what it is that you need to know in your life. But I think we need to be conscious of the fact that this is a product that is being made, being manufactured at the very least, so that we can take some of that responsibility back into our own hands as to what do we want to put into our minds as the news of the day, and what sources will we at least turn to in order to start constructing a more accurate map of reality. Because I think that is ultimately what we are attempting to do when we look at the news. We are attempting to create some sort of map of reality that will help us guide us through the navigation of this terrain. But the more of a disconnect that we have between that map and the real world, the more we start to understand, oh, this map isn't helping us to understand and live our lives. It's actually guiding us towards something completely different than generally something that we don't want for ourselves.
James, we've only got a minute and a half left in this segment. Could you give a quick rundown of Operation Mockingbird and what was discovered about the press and the CIA?
Yes. So in the 1970s, there were a series of hearings regarding the CIA and its operations, quite illegal, of course, going against the CIA's charter, against Americans and spreading information, misinformation, etc., in America, targeting American citizens. As part of that, in the hearings, it was admitted that there was a CIA relationship with a number of media organs. And I can't remember the exact people who were testifying in that, but it's easily found online. But there mm-hmm. was a seminal article written by Carl Bernstein in Rolling Stone in the 1970s called The CIA and the Media, which goes through and talks about those relationships and what was uncovered at that time in the 1970s, including this program, which has come under the name Operation Mockingbird. I don't believe that's what it was internally called by the CIA. But anyway, to actually implant CIA, if not CIA assets, at least CIA-friendly journalists within the news media to report on things, to gather information for the CIA, etc., in the service of a larger intelligence operation. And that is all 100% documented on the record. Sure. No question about it. This is not conspiracy theory.
And Americans will be glad to know that the later director of the CIA, George Herbert Walker Bush, said, oh, we don't do that anymore. And I guess that's something you can take to the bank. Friends, we come back and continue our conversation of James with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. We're talking about news as a social construct, how to be an intelligent consumer of media. Remember, our rallying cry here at the Catholic Current is Christus Mundum, Mundus Christo, bringing Christ to the world and the world to Christ. We do it because our Lord says so, for the greater glory of God, the love of our neighbor, and the salvation of our own soul. After the broadcast today, go to thestationofthecross.com, get our resources list, download our audio as podcast. Take us to your family and friends. Together we'll take it to the whole world. Be back in just 2 minutes. Please do stay with us. Praise be Jesus Christ. This is Father Robert McTague of the Society of Jesus, your daily host for the Catholic Current, where we bring Christ to the world and the world to Christ. You're listening to us from the Station of the Cross studios, your local radio station, and the iCatholic Radio mobile app, where we proclaim the fullness of truth with clarity and charity. Just a reminder, the end of August, we're having a big shindig marking the 25th anniversary of the Station of the Cross. You can meet us all at Niagara. To find out more about this and to participate in the celebrations, go to the Station of the Cross. My returning guest is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. We're talking about news as a social construct. James, I'm sure you've heard the old saw about the two things you don't want to see being made are sausage and legislation. Years later, I added two more. You don't want to see personnel decisions being made by academics or clergy. But also decisions about how the media is made, and it is certainly made, even curated, one might say. And the more I spent time in Washington, D.C., I was assistant administrator of a law firm, I was a researcher in a government think tank, I saw lots of rocks that I looked under, and I didn't like what I saw. And now that I've been working in media in recent years, my worst suspicions are confirmed, and then some. But I want to use as a test case the events of Rwanda, the Rwandan genocide. And now that's going back some years, and I watched the television with horror and wondered about the human condition and God and the problem of evil and all that. And then it was just kind of in the background. It was in a part of my mental furniture. But looking at some of the work that you have done recently, the story we were told was certainly a story. It was a story told with a purpose, but it wasn't necessarily a story that comported with the facts. Can you fill us in on that, please?
Yes. For people who are interested in the big exploration of this, I just released a podcast called The Rwandan Genocide is a Lie. So if you look that up on my website, you'll be able to find that. And I go into a great degree of detail on this. And I realize that's a provocative title, and it might make people believe that what I am asserting is that nothing happened in 1994 in Rwanda, that no one died or something along those lines. That, of course, is not what I am saying. But the story of the Rwandan genocide, the story that we all saw playing out on our TV screens or in the newspapers there in 1994, is actually perhaps a perfect example of the way that news can be constructed and manipulated, not by reporting things that are factually untrue, but by reporting them in a way that is so contextless or so de-rooted from any sort of context that it becomes a very different story entirely. So in this particular case, we get a handle on this from interrogating the very notion, which is absolutely core to the whole narrative of the Rwandan genocide as it's been handed down, is that this was an event of absolute madness that took place in 100 days. There are the so-called 100 days from April 7th of 1994 until July, whatever it was, in which we saw 800,000, question mark, no one knows exactly, but hundreds of thousands, perhaps even over a million Rwandans slaughtered. And the way that that was portrayed, and I remember this vividly from my own childhood, I remember watching this and seeing the coverage of it, it was the Hutus went crazy and started killing Tutsis. And we were vaguely informed something about Hutus and Tutsis. Yeah, I don't know. It's some kind of African tribal thing, right? some sort of ancient conflict, who knows where it came from. But if we interrogate that 100 days notion and start looking at the context of what happened in 1994, it starts to paint a very, very different story. And as always, the question is, where do you start the clock on this? And you could go back to the 18th or 19th century. You could talk about the early 20th century and the colonial roots of the division as it was manifested in colonial times between Hutus and Tutsis, and even Tutsis and Tutsi elites, and Tutsi as a class construct, not a tribal conflict, etc. But in order to even just start the clock somewhere manageable, you could just go back to 1990, which is when the fighting actually began between essentially a cadre of Tutsi elites who were the former monarchs of Rwanda back in the pre-colonial times, who had been essentially rousted from power and lost the monarchy in the Rwandan Revolution in the 1960s, and that precipitated a number of Hutu-led governments that the Tutsi elites were obviously not happy with because they wanted to be in power again. They ended up forming something called the Rwandan Patriotic Front in Uganda, and the RPF was responsible for a number of attacks. The fighting between the RPF and the Rwandan government really began in earnest in October 1990. So from that point on, you had years of attacks and various events, violent skirmishes, etc., essentially invasions from Uganda into Rwanda that were taking place in all of this time. And it was on April 6, 1994, the day before this 100 days began, that the Rwandan president was assassinated. His plane was brought down, and there is still an open question as to how exactly that took place or who ordered it, but there is very good reason to believe it was the RPF, the elite Tutsis, who were a part of that assassination, and even a Tutsi prince, who would have been the hereditary monarch of Rwanda if the monarchy had kept in power, himself said that the fighting on April 6th actually began right after the president was assassinated. The RPF started attacking the Rwandans, which is exactly opposite to the narrative that was portrayed in the 1990s there. It was the Hutus that went crazy and started killing all the Tutsis for some reason or other. Well, when you start to look at this and put it in its context, what you find is this was not a 100 days of madness, that, or even if it was 100 days of madness, it was 100 days of madness that followed years of military incursions and skirmishes and violence and brutality that had been going on for a very long time with very, very deep roots in Rwandan history that was not a genocide, a mad genocide in the way that we expect that to work. And one indication of that is that these numbers are contested, but by some academic scholars' assessment, there were actually more Hutus killed than Tutsis. So how could the genociders actually die in greater numbers than the people being genocided? That right there should at least put a question mark over the narrative that we were sold in 1994. But I guess that leads to the question, why? Why then was this narrative constructed? What was the purpose of this narrative? And we see that really from the time that it was being constructed right on through the 1990s into the 2000s with the elaboration of this idea, this ideology that was being pushed largely through the United Nations and NATO of R2P, the responsibility to protect. And the idea was that the whole world just watched in silence as this horrible genocide was going on in Rwanda, and they didn't send troops and they didn't stop it. It was the international community's obligation to have stepped in and done something, and they didn't. And therefore, we can never let that happen again. Therefore, we need some sort of standing military force that will be there on a moment's notice, probably under UN command, that will be able to intervene in any situation where there could be the possibility of genocide. And we saw how that R2P philosophy played out in such places as Libya, where we remember we were told Gaddafi was about to start wantonly slaughtering his own population for some reason or other, so we had to go in guns blazing. NATO did exactly that, bombed the country to smithereens. Gaddafi was killed in a vile and despicable manner. And what resulted from that? Who cares? Whatever. Moving on. That's not news anymore. Oh, by the way, now Libya has literally open-air slave markets operating in Libya. That's how much we cared about the Libyans. So this is part of a much, much broader story that is being constructed in the news media, but essentially the idea of the Rwandan genocide was perpetrated on the American public and people around the world in order to convince them of this need to be able to intervene in any situation at the drop of a hat when the news tells us that something is about to happen. Oh, Gaddafi is about to slaughter his people, therefore we have to go into Libya, etc.
Friends, we're talking about news as a social construct. My returning guest is James Corbett of The Corbett Report. James, as I read your evidence, you know, you say, don't take my word for it, look at my evidence, all the details. The narrative begins to unravel, and it starts to throw doubt on other events at that time. When Yugoslavia came apart, there was somebody we had to bomb, and there was someone we had to rescue. And honestly, I think most Americans wouldn't remember who we bombed and who it was that we rescued. But it was a vast and urgent thing, and no less a moral exemplar than Bill Clinton said he was haunted by not intervening in Rwanda, and therefore never again. So is this kind of a familiar recipe that, something vast and urgent must be done? You have to give us more power immediately, only temporarily. Oh, my goodness, look at those broken bodies. Is it your view that things like that happen, I'm just taking it from an American perspective, with the falling apart of Yugoslavia and then with Iraq and then with Afghanistan, Iran, all these things that were great events of my coming into maturity, I'm kind of looking at it in a much more skeptical way now. Am I facing in the right direction? And can you answer that in 2 minutes before the break?
Well, I'll do my best. But yes, okay. you touched on a number of things that that I have talked about before, and I strongly think are important for people to cogitate about. And one of them is the idea of, as you say, using emergency situations or emergency powers, which then ultimately are never revoked or only partially revoked, as the pretense for a power grab. Another is, for example, you raised the Yugoslav example. Well, how about in the, as you say, most people don't even remember the Serbs and, Bosnians or so. What was all that about? Well, as it turns out, NATO was working closely with Al-Qaeda terrorists in Yugoslavia because they were the good guys in that narrative that was being framed for us by the media a couple of years before, of course, the 9/11 attacks. So back when it was okay to work with Islamic extremists. And as you say, I think it is a cynical use of essentially a strategy to get the public rallied around the flag in times of war. And in days of old, a king could simply order his army out into the field, and if they didn't, he would just execute them. In the enlightened liberal democratic era of the 20th and 21st century, now leaders have to convince their population that there is a valid need for military intervention, and that is almost inevitably these days framed in humanitarian grounds. We can't have another Rwanda. We can't have another genocide go on, so we have to step in, and that's always the way it is framed, and it never quite turns out that way, for example, with the invasion of Afghanistan or Iraq.
Right. And I know as Americans, and this was something that I was taught growing up, America is the arsenal of democracy. Whoever we choose, they are always the good guys. So, let's lock and load and go save the world. Again, I look at the world differently now. Friends, when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with James Corbett of The Corbett Report. We're talking about news as a social construct. We're going to be having a lot of links to James' good work. After the broadcast today, go to thestationofthecross.com, get our resources list, download our audio as podcast. Wherever you can find audio, you can find us. Follow us on your favorite platform, write a 5-star review. We need to attract the attention of the listeners so that these conversations get the attention they deserve. Take us to your family and friends. Together, we'll take it to the whole world. Back in just 2 minutes. Please do stay with us. Praise be Jesus Christ. This is Father Robert McTague of the Society of Jesus, your daily host for the Catholic Current, where we bring Christ to the world and the world to Christ. You're listening to us from the Station of the Cross studios, your local radio station, and the iCatholic Radio mobile app, where we proclaim the fullness of truth with clarity and charity. We're talking about the news as a social construct. My returning guest is James Corbett of the Corbett Report. Quick reminder, we have our 25th anniversary celebration at the end of August. We're going to be meeting at the Convention Center in Niagara. We'd love to have you there with us. Go to thestationthecross.com/25 for more details. James, I was always a news junkie. I wanted to be informed. I wanted to know what was going on in the world. I wanted to know where the money was being spent and who was pulling the strings. When I entered the Society of Jesus in the summer of 1990, in January of 91, we began what was called the Long Retreat, and it's 30 days in silence, cut off from the world. And Father had mentioned at Mass that a shooting war had begun with Iraq, the first Gulf War. And I made kind of a command decision to break the rules and walk off the grounds every day down the hill a couple miles into town. And there was a local store that had the local newspaper in the window. And every day I would read the headlines. And usually it was local news about some local boy is now slinging hash in the army. And then just above the fold, there'd be some reference to Iraqi scuds. And I did this for weeks in weather foul or fair. And finally, towards the end of the retreat, the poor guy saw me standing out there. He must have recognized me. He just handed me a free newspaper. Obviously, I couldn't bring it back to the retreat house, so I sat on a park bench in a snowstorm to read the newspaper because I thought I had a commitment to what was going on in the world. You were probably much younger than I was when that broke out, but I know you have your own odyssey with news. Would you share that with us, please?
Well, in fact, I do remember, actually, when that broke out. And I certainly remember that that was around the time it was near the beginning of CNN and the 24-hour news idea.
Right.
Which
right.
In and of itself was an innovation, which we now take completely for granted. In fact, we've moved beyond that. We're now in the, as I call it, the 60-24 news cycle, which is every single minute there is a news item mm-hmm. taking place going across the news feeds. But back at that time, the 24-hour news idea itself was somewhat novel. And so I remember the CNN coverage, and I remember watching it even as a young child. But I will just throw this out there for people who are interested in this story. If you type in "the Gulf War did not take place" into my search bar, you will find a podcast that I did where I talked about the concept that was thrown out there by French philosopher Jean Baudrillard. He wrote a series of essays at the time, shortly before the Gulf War was set to take place. He wrote an essay entitled "The Gulf War Will Not Take Place." As it was happening, he wrote an essay called "The Gulf War, Is It Really Taking Place?" Which he answered himself shortly after the Gulf War took place with an essay called "The Gulf War Did Not Take Place." And that's collected in a book that is available. You can read it online at archive.org, for example. I would suggest people who are interested, at least people who can stomach French philosophy, it's quite dense, but it is right. It is fascinating. And essentially, he is making a type of argument that the Gulf War, so to speak, was more of a media phenomenon than it was anything resembling what we would refer to as a war. And of course, it does not, even just from first glance, it does not parse with anything we understand to be warfare of armies lining up on battlefields shooting at each other. It wasn't that type of war. So what type of war was it? Well, at any rate, you can read Baudrillard's response to that. And I think it's worth taking into account as we're talking about news and its ability to construct reality rather than report on reality. What was the Gulf War and what really happened there? And how do we know about what happened there? Are all, you know, valid questions to be asking in this incredibly artificially constructed media age that we're living in.
You know, my students didn't believe me when I told them that the television would go off the air. You know, you'd watch a movie or something like that about 12:30, 1 o'clock. There was the national anthem, and that was it. Television was over till, you know, the farm report at 5 or 6 in the morning. That doesn't mean anything to them anymore. Can you talk a little bit about the news cycle and the 24/7 news cycle becoming the tail that wags the dog?
Yes, well, it's one of those things that, again, we've become so used to, and people growing up today, I suppose, just take for granted, that we don't think to question it. But the idea that news is something that needs to be reported on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, at all times, is itself a very, very, very modern recent construct. In fact, even the concept of the news itself is a construct, and that's the basis of our conversation here today. But it is worth thinking about the idea that 1,000 years ago, what would people have even understood that concept to be, the news? At the very best, perhaps something that, you know, you'd have a town crier that would go through talking about the latest royal proclamation, or maybe you'd get a news of events that had taken place in some neighboring town or something like that once a week, or something along those lines. But the idea that news was something that was happening in the world that would then be collected and reported on and written down into some sort of format resembling, say, a newspaper, all of that is a relatively, on the larger scale of things, a relatively recent idea. And so the idea of taking that idea of collecting and putting news into a package and then doing that constantly so that it literally never stops 24 hours a day. Not only is that sort of a strange thing to conceive of, it also, of course, necessitates the creation and construction of a news product, essentially, a never-ending stream of stories. And the only way to do that, of course, is to report, quote in quotation marks, on more and more things that would not have entered your field of view even a few decades ago, before this 24/7 news cycle began. Now there needs to be some sort of product to put in front of you, so they will find something resembling a news story, or what you take to be a news story. And one idea along those lines that really strikes me, I remember vividly being about 10 or 11 years old, sitting there watching the evening news with my dad one day, and there was some story on the evening news that I can't remember specifically what it was they were talking about, but at the end of it, I remember thinking, what was the news value of that? And I turned to my dad and said, was that a news story or an advertisement for whatever product they were talking about in that news story? And my dad just looked at me and said, I think it was an advertisement, son. And I remember that moment because it struck me, oh, yes, this is not something that they're just going out and finding the news. No, they are creating narratives. Right. And if that takes the form of a, hey, look at this new product that will change your life, what is the difference between that and an advertisement?
I want to talk a little bit about the they, you know, so we go from the French philosophy to the German philosophy and Heidegger and so on, Das Man, you know, they make the news in such a way that it becomes addictive. I mean, we've known that you go into a passive state in front of a television, you become very suggestible in front of a screen, and then they want you addicted either to, you know, whether it's the obvious lust of pornography or the drug of indignation, and people get caught in doom scrolling. And you're anxious, you're afraid, you're isolated, you become dependent. Is it fair to say that the 24-hour news cycle is a really useful tool for people who want to manipulate other people?
I think that is a fairly safe observation to make, yes. And what you are talking about comports with what we understand about the psychology of people. Essentially, this is the reason, for example, why news is always this disastrous thing happened. No matter how disconnected that disastrous thing might be from your particular lived daily reality, the fact that there was some earthquake halfway around the world that killed 3,000 people is a tragedy, of course. But in what sense does it constitute a news story that you need to know about? Well, essentially, this is the question which necessitates, or in the minds of the news reading public, necessitates, oh, well, we must know about the horrible things that happened and good things that are happening, even good things that are happening in your backyard. Well, that's not news. That's some sort of feel-good story that maybe they'll tack on to the end of a news broadcast as just a way of lightening the mood before they let you go into the commercial break. But but we don't tend to associate those things with news itself. And I think that's an important part of the way that, yes, we've come to be habituated to understand news to be essentially as people say, doom scrolling or doom porn. It is about the horrible things, and there's an obvious reason for that. As human beings, obviously, we look for and try to identify problems in the world so that we can be ready for them, prepare ourselves for them, take action against them. That is a good and healthy part of human society. But when that becomes the overwhelming urge that we are constantly looking for problems, it does start to affect people and puts them into the type of, well, mindset that we can see our people being engaged in right now with their endless doom scrolling through endless news feeds.
And this strikes me as a really anti-human, anti-humane dynamic that we're talking about. So if we're constantly afraid, if we're constantly angry and indignant, if we're treating each other as potential vectors of either violence or virus, there's really nothing to do but to isolate and, you know, connect it to Pornhub and have food delivered by DoorDash and toys delivered by Amazon and just become passive, obedient, frightened consumers. I mean, yeah. if you or I were evil geniuses, wouldn't the script start to include some of this in outline?
Yes, and it really does make you question then whether this is part of a deliberately constructed plan or whether this is simply the nature of the way that this media operates. And if people really start diving into this, I will recommend as one useful resource for this, I did a documentary called The Media Matrix, which is available for, on my site completely for free, as all my work, corporatereport.com/media. But if you want to dive even deeper, I did a 6-hour online course that goes deep, deep, deep into this research called Mass Media, A History. And in that course, I talk, again, I say Jean Baudrillard, once again, on his work on simulacra and simulation. And the idea being that in the age of electronically mediated reality that we're living in, what we have is not so much tangible present objects, so much as simulacra. This simulated almost like it's a real experience in the way that pornography is the simulacra of real loving relationship, or the DoorDash experience is the simulacrum of an actual dining experience, etc., etc. All we have are these ephemeral mediated experiences that are coming at us through this screen. And unfortunately, the way things are heading, that will probably be only more and more and more apparent and more part of our reality as we start to literally strap ourselves into the hyper reality, mixed reality, VR, whatever they're calling it this week, goggle vision monstrosities that are going to replace authentic human experience. And again, yes, if we were creating a system where people could be completely isolated and thus controlled and just become mindless consumer automatons, you would be hard pressed to find a way to do this more effectively. However, I think this is really just embedded in the nature of media itself, and it really should cause us to question, at the very least, our relationship to media and how much time we spend in mediated reality versus actual authentic human experience.
I remember when you could still get into contact with the internet through a dial-up modem, Cliff Stoll, who was a computer pioneer, wrote a book called Selling Silicon Snake Oil. And he said, rather than go to websites to talk about baking bread, go bake bread. Go do real things. And I traveled recently, and every child and every senior citizen and everyone in between was locked into a device. I said, this can't be good for the human condition. It's certainly not good for human relationships. Friends, when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about news as a social construct. My returning guest is James Corbett. Follow his good, his excellent work at The Corbett Report. We'll be linking to that website. Be part of the conversation. Follow what we're following by following us on Gab. That's GAB.com. The channel is The Catholic Current. And you can influence the conversation. You can contact us at thestationofthecross.com/askfather. Your comments, your questions, we deal with all of them. We take them to heart. We're doing this good work together. Be back in just 2 minutes. Please do stay with us.
The Catholic Current with Father Robert Matteig, asking the important questions that you need to hear.
Well, that's an excellent question.
Another really great question.
It's interesting you mentioned that, Father.
That's a good question.
Yes. Yes, thank you for this good question.
Oh, good question.
5 p.m. daily from the Station of the Cross Catholic Media Network and the iCatholic Radio mobile app. Have a question or feedback about today's episode? Want to suggest a guest or a future topic? Go to thestationofthecross.com/askfather and help influence the conversation.
Praise be Jesus Christ. This is Father Robert McTague of the Society of Jesus, your daily host for the Catholic Current, where we bring Christ to the world and the world to Christ. You're listening to us from the Station of the Cross Studios, your local radio station, and the iCatholic Radio mobile app, where we proclaim the fullness of truth with clarity and charity. Quick reminder, the end of August, we're having our 25th anniversary celebration for the Station of the Cross. We want you to join us at the Convention Center at Niagara. To learn how to be part of the fun, go to thestationofthecross.com/25. We're talking about the news as a social construct. My returning guest is James Corbett of The Corbett Report. James, you, like me, you found yourself in media not as a result of your own plan or design or aspiration. I certainly didn't end up that way. And you and I have learned to become discriminating consumers of information, media, and so on. You've been doing this a lot longer than I have. Can you recommend best practices to the listeners?
Yes, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to do this. For people who don't follow my work, I do like to try to focus on what we can actually do about problems rather than simply dwelling on the problems. So this is an important question. And I would say that whatever causes you to be a more active participant in the construction of the narratives that shape your life is for the better. And by that, I mean that when you think about it, the whole system of media narrative control that we've been talking about is predicated on the idea that you are a passive consumer of information and that your only power is to choose whether to tune into ABC or CBS or CNN, or no, I will choose to go to the internet and read, you know, CNN.com or something along those lines. But I think it's more, it's much deeper than that. And that is why one of the core principles of my work, and something that the Corbett Report was founded upon, was the idea of open source information, by which I mean when I construct a podcast or a report, I will always link you to the sources of the information that I'm talking about. If I cite a report, obviously I'll link to that. If I play a video, I will link to that. If I make a statement, I try to link to the source of the information that I got that from. Specifically for the reason that I think it is incumbent on consumers of information, what a horrible term, to become participants in the construction of their worldview by interrogating those pieces of information that may be new to them, looking at the sources of the information, deciding for yourself whether, oh, okay, this is where he got that piece of information, but do I agree with that? Do I think this is a good source? Do I think they're talking about it in the right way? Did James interpret this correctly? And to the extent that people take it on board for themselves to start interrogating where this information come from, I think that is a win. And I put this in the context of, I remember very vividly 10, 15, 20 years ago, noting that NewYorkTimes.com, CNN.com, they would post information in the exact same way that they would have posted things back in the 20th century mass media paradigm of newspapers and television, which is they tell you this, and you just trust them because, though, they have a whole editorial division and fact checkers and they could be sued, so they must be telling the truth. They must have their sources correct. But you would just have to trust them. They would write, for example, about a government report, but they wouldn't actually link to the report itself, so you could read it for yourself. And that has thankfully started to change in recent years. But still, I think that is why I came on the scene in 2007 with the Corbett Report being focused on open intelligence, the idea that we have as much a role in putting this information together as the editors in some newsroom halfway around the world. To that extent, I think that's the bare minimum of what we can and should be doing, is taking a more active role in essentially becoming our own editors of information rather than relying on others to do that for us. Having said all of that, as I say, I think there are structural issues with regards to the media itself and the way that media operates on us as human beings that may be impossible to escape so long as we are in mediated experience, which raises the question, well, then, how can we live the authentic human non-mediated experience in the 21st century given the structures of the society around us? And, well, that's a question that's above my pay grade, but it's something that I think should at least be on the table for conversation because it is exceptionally important as we start slipping down this rabbit hole into literally strapping on the VR goggles and being invested in this media space 100% of our waking lives. That's the nightmare that I think we at least need to start thinking about before it becomes a reality.
Well, I want to recommend to my listeners and to you, James, Professor Alan Jacobs has a book that came out in 2015 called Reading in an Age of Distraction. And there's just something that happens to you, to your brain, I would say to your soul as well, when you're reading for long periods of time. We used to know how to do this and how to teach people to do it and so on. And we've got people so immersed, pickled, marinated in electronic stuff that we're losing that ability. And I can say as a recovering university professor, that adversely affects a student's ability to analyze and to write and to argue and so on. They're more adept at emoting and being triggered, but not very much else. So I think we have to learn how to recover a sense of attention and a sense of concentration and also a sense of vulnerability. I don't think people understand how susceptible they are to suggestion. James, you've mentioned you've been doing this since 2007. That's a long time. That's a lot of work. I'm still making my way through your archives, and I've been following your work for a couple of years now. Why do you keep doing it?
That's an
I'm going to guess it's not. Yeah. I'm going to guess it's not because you're getting rich.
Well, no, it's there. To a certain extent, it is now literally how I make my living. So I suppose there is that aspect to it. What compelled me in the first place was essentially the fact that I could see the discrepancy between the information I could see on the screen, those talking heads on network news or what have you, versus the information that I could find and discover and research and verify for myself through this incredible library of Alexandria that is now the online treasure trove of the internet age. That discrepancy was so vast that I thought, well, I can't just sit here. I have to do something. I have to insert myself into this and whatever way I can, just put my voice out there to try to raise awareness about these issues. And I think that is still a fundamental drive for me. Perhaps even more selfishly, I would probably be doing a lot of this research myself anyway. So it's good to have this outlet in which I can put it together. And as I'm sure you're aware, there's a difference between simply passively reading and learning about something and then actually trying to present it to others. And process, I think I come to a better understanding of the material myself and my own awareness of how this material fits together. So perhaps from a selfish perspective, it's good for me to be able to put this out in a format that makes me collect my thoughts and put them out that way. And thankfully, I have heard from many, many people over the years that it does help them as well to make sense of the world. And I think that's ultimately what I am attempting to do, is to try to take this decontextualized bits and snippets of information here and there and put them together in a way that actually helps people understand the world they are living in. And the extent to which I do that, I will say, is the extent to which I am successful in my task.
Well, I am a success stories of yours, James. I navigate the world better because of your good work, and I'm grateful for the stimulating conversation, and I do look forward to next time.
And that's the way the world is.
That's the way it is.
From the Bohemian Grove. Yes.
Not from the Bohemian Grove. I'm Jesuit Father Robert McKaig, your host here every day of the Catholic Current. Join us tomorrow. Welcome back my curmudgeon in arms, Father John Perricone. I'm going to ask him whether Christ has been domesticated in our lifetime. After the broadcast today, go to thestationofthecross.com, get our resources list, download our audio as podcast. Everything you need to take this to your family and friends, we give to you. Together, let's take it around. around the world. We can do it with you. We cannot do it without you. Let's do this good work together. Through the intercession of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, may Mighty God bless you, keep us from all harm and every evil until you reach the happiness of heaven. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, go in peace and please do pray for me.